Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hey.
I like it. Good look.
Yeah, it's just subtle. gentlemen, how are you doing?
Man, if I was any busier, I'd be a busy person.
Yeah, you know, it's a good time. The spring has sprung. You know, the temps are up, and so is the fervor of another Weird Things week, in my opinion.
Bold take.
Yeah.
I would say that there's a lot of stuff that's gone on in AI this week, but actually it's been kind of, you know, relatively not as crazy as it was the last couple of weeks there.
Well, luckily we've got a couple of weeks to catch up on. What are the things we should be thinking about? I've been out of the loop.
I would say a couple of the big changes that have happened have been, we're watching a lot of progression with code models, and, you know, Claude Code, Claude Work has become pretty popular. And then OpenAI's Codex has just been like blowing up as far as usage and whatnot. And it's kind of crazy to see that. And we saw NVIDIA made a deal a few weeks back for Grok, that's GROQ. They're a company that makes really high speed inference, and they're going to start selling chips for that. And then OpenAI made a deal, Cerebrus, which had like the fastest like AI platform out there for like serving models. And OpenAI started shipping that inside of Codex. And we did demos, I think, before showing you how fast Cerebrus is, where it's insane. It's just like literally you ask a question, by the time you hit enter, you get the response.
Yeah.
And we're going to start entering into this era of like just super, super fast AI models.
It is essentially real-time inference, right? Like you are responding in conversational time where, like, and let's just use an example. When you're using any of these voice modes, let's say that you were an 80 something Vermont senator and you were going to talk with a voice model. There are little, you know, ways that it can use the human language to mask the fact that it is thinking about getting you the right answer. It ultimately wants to be useful. It wants to give you something that is worth your time, but some of the semantic ways that they can do that is, to camouflage it. This would essentially be able to give you exactly what its best guess is because it is just that lightning fast, like these Grok and Cerebrus chips.
So you mentioned Vermont Senator. I saw a headline about Bernie Sanders talking to Claude. Was that interesting or what was there?
One of Andrew and I's favorite memes, which we have found each other sending to each other more frequently, is a meme in which one of the white meme stick figure kind of crude drawings, a man says to a computer, tell me you're alive. And then the computer says back, I'm alive. And then the man goes, oh my God, as if he has just discovered something like truly amazing. And so the Bernie Sanders bit was like, tell me you're a scary robot. And the Claude model says, I'm a scary robot. And then he's like, oh my God.
This really is. It's the, I remember we were having a conversation at one of our favorite haunts with my 17-year-old daughter at the time. And we were talking about how all of the, you know, your TikTok algorithm or whatever, it just tattles on you. So whatever you call TikTok is you're talking about yourself. It's like, I was watching TikTok, the booty shaking app. It's like, all right, now today I learned.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that we're in a very strange place with artificial intelligence in terms of the discourse, because there has been a lot of time, effort, money, ink spent on the concept of the outer edges of what happens when this gets very, very smart, right? Like that is something that has been talked about a lot. then there is what we know about these tools right now. You know, there's a kind of outer edge thing, and then there's a real time question that we have, and increasingly they're not the same. Like the model that exists today is extraordinarily helpful. It is extraordinarily productive. You can do a lot of good things with it, and it has its own contours. It's not, you know, I mean, you can make debates on whether or not we would call models like we have today AGI 5 years ago. And I think we might think about it, but right now we don't consider it something that is artificially generally intelligent. We don't think it's artificial super intelligence. And yet a lot of these things are kind of conflated. And so when you see a video like that, it is, or what that meme is making fun of is the idea that a more simplistic, although impressive, incredibly impressive tool can, you know, we're constantly looking for it to be proof of the other thing, of this scary apocalyptic world. And so you can just say, confirm my priors, and then it will confirm your priors. And then you're like, geez, look, it said it. It said it.
Oh my God, he admitted.
Exactly. Exactly. Is that right, Andrew?
Yeah, and I'll tell you a thing too. It's that you brought up something interesting about the voice thing. Not all voice models are the same. And not to disparage the work of one company over another, is that I watched a demo come out a couple weeks ago. And I worked, when I was at OpenAI, I was in the room and we'd get the updates and they would show like the voice model improving. And the latency was a big important thing. How long between when you finish saying something, the model responds. And the challenge is, if you know, anybody who switches from voice mode to text mode, the text mode models are much smarter than the voice mode models. But even the voice mode, there was this push to not try to do filler words and do this stuff, but you'd see all the tricks, or you'd be aware of all the tricks that people use. And I remember seeing a demo a couple of weeks, like, oh my God, this new voice model is insane. And it was doing, hum, let me look into that.
Yeah.
Let me see. Okay, yeah. Interesting. I'm like, oh, this is terrible latency. And I'm watching technical people fall for the trick, which was like, I was literally like, you know, like, why are you falling for this? This is not good. That's not how you measure it. And there are ways you can measure latency, by the way. OpenAI has a new model, a new voice model, the 1.5 voice model. Go in there and say, hey, I want you to say the last number when I start counting and stop, and how quickly it comes up with the last number. Not go, well, let me see, whatever. That's a great...
They did update the voice model. I was just about to ask how... Because to be honest, as the text models got so good, I've drifted away from even using the advanced voice.
Well, the latency has improved a lot. The model, the intelligence behind the model, I don't know where that is, but I'm saying the latency and just their API model, their latency, to my understanding, is way lower than anybody else's models. And I've seen some people come out with stuff that like, oh, look at this. And it does a lot of, interesting. And that's literally just insert that while it thinks. But the new model, the latency has gotten much better, you know, but as far as the capability, I think we'll probably start to see them get a lot smarter. But just the problem, it's just when you go use the text model, you take how long it takes for it to respond in text. The voice model can't be any faster than that.
Yeah, right.
You know, but I've always used voice in like walkie-talkie mode too, because to me, that's just like an easier way to do it. But we'll do a little demo here if I can share a screen.
Yeah.
Or I have no idea how to share a screen here.
Oh, yeah. No, I guess we can't. You'll have to talk
me
through
it. If you want to, well, you have to go create an account. I was going to say on Cerebrus.ai, which is worth doing just to play around with, but you can see the speed at which you're able to generate stuff.
Oh.
And like, I just...
Cerebras.ai.
Cerebras.
Cerebras. Here we go. Here, I'll go ahead and do the get started dance.
So I tell people, play with these things. Learn what they can do. You know, because I think that the better you get, you know, at using these things, you know, the better you're going to experience and whatnot. And I think that that's literally, you know, the best way to sort of learn where things are headed is just to actively play with these tools.
Yeah.
I'm telling people, get Codex, by the way. Like, if you have a ChatGPT plan, get Codex. Get Codex, if you want to Claude code, whatever. Just play with these things. Start throwing projects at it. Find out what it can and can't do. And you'll start to understand. you know, just the upper limits of capabilities. Details.
There we go.
Justin, what should be an experience with Codex?
You know, I mean, Codex has been like a thing that I find myself needing to carve out more time. I think that is a kind of next level thing for non-coders to understand, is that like, this is a process that does take a little time. And what Codex allows you to do is bridge a lot of the knowledge gap and a lot of the time gap that it usually took to do stuff. But it is something that you really want to put, you know, you want to put front of mind, especially if you're understanding this version of new skills. But it, man, I cannot tell you what a game changer it is to have a vibe coding tool and also unlimited patience from another model that I can just ask the dumbest questions possible. Like I can just continue to be remedial, and it will hold my hand and answer any dumb question that I needed to, so I can just understand the fundamentals of this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Increasingly, yeah. Just as a little tidbit, I've found that spot checking, having one AI spot check another one's work, is a very good habit to get into. Less, I suspect it'll become less necessary over time, but like, either I can check, like for example, during a lot of the live streams, I'll encode something with either a ROT13 or a Vigneur cipher or whatever. And sometimes you catch a sleepy AI kind of phoning it in. But then what I'll do is, if I encode it with one AI, I'll have the other one like, hey, decode it. And then sometimes it comes up with gibberish and it reveals the hallucination that otherwise would have been too tedious for me to find on my own. But that idea of just knowing that a thing is possible and constantly cross-referencing and having even it check its own work has been extremely productive.
There's right now, OpenAI is doing a contest called Parameter Golf. It is basically try to train this tiny little GPT-2 model using very limited amount of compute, like literally like 10 minutes on an H100 or something like that, and only 18 megabytes for the size of the code that's going to do the training. And, you know, for fun, I put that into Codex. I said, hey, can you make me an HTML website that explains all this just in simple terms? And it did. And it created sliders and all sorts of other stuff. There's tools. You know, Google has Notebook LM, and Google has, by the way, Stitch. You should check out if you're doing interface design. A lot of cool tools out there. But I love the fact, I'm like, oh, can you make me an interactive website just to explain this? And that's one thing that's just super, super cool now. And all the frontier models have their way of doing this, is you can say, I want you to take a thing and explain it to me. You know, you could literally, if you were trying to do, let's say, podcasting or OSTB, like, oh, could you just make me a whole thing that explains how to set up the server? And it is just not asking great questions, because these tools are so beyond that now.
Yeah. You mentioned frontier models, Maine. Let me ask you this, because we saw some headlines over the last few months with Meta that some of the models that they've worked on aren't ready for prime time. We saw a lot of layoffs on the metaverse and VR side of that house, which is something that they had so much faith in that they renamed their company. Meanwhile, Google had a really, really good push. They had an exceptional 2025 that seemed to put them in a really great position this year. And despite the fact that Anthropic is shipping like at a really, really high level, OpenAI is shipping at a really, really high level. I mean, obviously you see a lot of time and money going into XAI. We'll see exactly where that lands them by the end of the year, but you haven't really seen it in the same way with Google. Their products are still kind of not where you would want to. Like, if you're going to look at, just from your dispassionate point of view, what are the lead dogs in terms of pushing this forward at the kind of breakneck pace that we have expected the industry? Are you factoring in Google and Meta in the same way that we might have expected them to be 2 years ago?
Well, Google's a weird one because, you know, they do an update to Stitch, their layout design thing, and people are like, hey, this could be the death of Figma.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not, but Stitch is, I played with it like for doing some demos, like what I played with looks like a fantastic thing. They don't really have an answer to agents right now. And that's been a thing they've expressed, like they're behind on agents, and that could cost them a lot because once you have really good agentic systems, you're able to accelerate faster. And Anthropic has good agentic systems. OpenAI has really good agentic systems. We see that. You look at the products between, I mean, there's just unbridled, you know, excitement over Claude Code. And now we're seeing that with Codex. So we see those two labs are in a great position there. I'd say that in some product space, I think Google's great. I think the model problem, Google models are weird. So last year was like, hey, Gemini 3 is here. It just won all the benchmarks. I don't know anybody who I know people use Gemini Flash, but I don't know anybody who uses the Frontier Gemini full Gemini 3 Pro model for it. And I'm not saying nobody does that. Let me be very clear. I just don't know anybody. They're either OpenAI or they're Anthropic, or they're using some Chinese knockoff model that was trained on both of them because it's super cheap. And I think that my belief is this. I want to be very careful because there are amazing world-class researchers at Google and doing amazing stuff. And you look at some of the stuff, AlphaFold, all these other stuff. There is great stuff there. For some reason, when it comes to that model that they do there, and like, by the way, Gemini 3 Flash, if you give it video, it's really good at video renders. And there's really good capabilities there. But being like this great overall model, Google models get kind of weird because once you, particularly I think like with code, once you start to try to code with them, you start to see these sort of weird gaps and you feel like, oh, they really pushed it hard on the benchmarks. Meanwhile, the teams that were great at doing something like video understanding could kind of let it cook and put that in there. And it was great. So just that they're considered, I would say in my circle, not as good as what the benchmarks would tell you they are when it comes to comparing them, let's say to 5.4 or Opus. But they are very good in some cases, in some situations there. I don't know. And I think that too, what's interesting is that, you know, OpenAI just announced 5.4 mini and 5.4 nano, and 5.4 mini is a super cheap model comparatively to what the other one probably as good as like GPT-5 was, like even though the bigger one. And you start to see that where OpenAI seems to be very good at training smaller models, Anthropic did that with Haiku, but they haven't done that lately. But Google Flash, very good small model for certain things. And so anyhow, Google came out with anti-gravity, which was their development environment. And then I think that sometimes people who just, a lot of Google people use Google products. It's the only thing they know about. I've had friends like, I use anti-gravity. What do you think these other tools? I never heard of them. And they go to the other tool like, oh my God, this is so much better.
And what about Meta?
But I also know that Meta
spent a lot of money last year. They went shopping.
Well, you had this, Meta and XAI, both similar situations.
Yeah.
Meta had, and Microsoft too, we can talk about that. So Meta did with the last, they had the Llama Maverick and whatnot, which were going to be like, they said, we're going to dominate open source and we're going to be the ones there. And of course they had a weird restrictive license too, which if you had more than like a billion users or whatever, you couldn't use it, which was sort of like, come on, you're saying Google and Microsoft can't use it. But when they did the last big model, it was like Llama 4. We talked about this before. The problem was it was they had one model they did benchmarking on, then one model they released. And if you looked at the two models, it looked like one model, they cooked it. They literally cooked the books. The term's called benchmaxed, where you basically just train a model to score as high as possible on the benchmarks, but it's not really useful. And that's what happened there. They literally went as far as to get benchmark scores on one model and release a different one, and they got called out on it.
Yeah.
And so they've got smart people there. You know, I have, you know, colleagues I worked with gone to try to work at Meta, but the problem is to be a frontier, you've got to have a really good research lab. And to have a good research lab, you've got to have researchers that are comfortable, have a lot of freedom to do things. And I think that Demis did that inside DeepMind for certain groups in certain areas. I know people, certain teams over at DeepMind, they're thrilled, love it. They have a lot of opportunity. But when it comes talk about Meta now. With Meta, they put Alexander Wang in charge. Alexander's super smart guy, but I don't know that Meta created that environment. where they were able to get, I think they could get some great people there, but I don't know that they were able to get people who were, I don't think they were able to build a great team yet. You know, we haven't seen it yet. They have built some great stuff. They have a model called Segment Anything, with which if you give it an image, it'll identify all the different parts of it. I was at BioHub, which is part of the Chan Zuckerberg Institute, and I watched this thing show you all the different parts of an of like a cell. They had a cell that went through a microscope and identified, and it was an incredible scientific achievement. So again, they have people building great things, but we don't know where they are in the model space, what's happening there. You know, rumors had been they thought they were trying to get something close, but they realized it wasn't going to be anywhere near what Anthropic or OpenAI were doing. And that's the thing, is like, do they want to put out a model that is like 10th best?
So yeah, let me ask you just that philosophically, because right now this is a field that is really, really dominated by a fairly narrow set of influence that is heavily social media and benchmarks dependent. Right. Like that is why people benchmark Max. It's why some of these influencers are getting these gigantic, like six figure deals to talk about certain AI tools, because if you get traction in those circles, it really matters. And everybody's looking for any, edge that they can get. But that being said, building a team and building a foundation is something that sometimes is not all about leaping to the front of the pack immediately. If you were running a lab, a main AI, right? Would you wait until you had something that was meaningfully, significantly pushing the frontier? Or is it good to put something out just so people know where you're going and you can have a foundation to build from?
The trick of it is just try to say, what is your ultimate goal? If your goal is to say, I'm going to compete with Anthropic and OpenAI, I think that's not probably a sharp goal to get into now, unless you have a lot. You know,
but that's Zuckerberg, what these guys are into, in, right? That's what Meta's into. That's what XAI is into. It's what Google believes they're there.
And we saw the problem. So Meta, you know, Google shows up late to the party. Google's got all the resources in the world. Google's got DeepMind. Google at least has a deep bench of AI researchers to go in there. And Google's making some very great products. Meta says, hey, we'll go for open source, because as long as we're making these great open source models, that's cool. But you're still kind of following what everybody else has done. You're not really a frontier lab if your goal is just to make, and also your business model starts to come into question. And we may see some of the Chinese open source models start to become closed source too. You have if everybody else for talent, and you have to identify who's the real talent, or who some people are great team members, and you pull a great team member and you put them into your company and you say, great, you have build your own team, and you do that, you find out that's not their strength. You know, they were great to put, you put them in a room with three other top AI researchers in the world, they'll do great work. You put them in a room by themselves, which they think they want,
yeah,
with other researchers that are under them, it's not the same thing. And I've seen that pattern again, like, oh, this person's a great team member, but if you just gave this person unlimited compute budget, do whatever, see him in 6 years,
yeah,
you know, and maybe you'll have something. That's part of the problem. So the Meta approach, though, was let's try to do this, but then they paid top dollar for all this talent, like top dollar. And they're like, oh, well, we haven't seen it yet. With XAI, this was the problem that other people had predicted, which is if it's an engineering thing, if you're a kid coming out of Purdue or coming out of some, you know, engineering program, there are only two really exciting companies to go work for: SpaceX and Tesla.
Yeah.
By far. Now I'd say Anduril is another exciting company to work for, but for the longest time, that was it. If you're coming out of a computer science program, or you're a mathematician, AI, whatever, where do you go? Well, you go to DeepMind, you go to OpenAI, you go to Anthropic, maybe you go to Microsoft Research, maybe you go to Meta, you know, and or you go to some other smaller. There's a lot of attractive places to go to, which made talent acquisition hard. And Elon, when he ran XAI, is like, well, I'll treat it like an engineer. I'll just throw a bunch of engineers at it. He threw some really smart engineers at it, but kind of with, and he had some researchers, but a lot of those researchers left. And what did they do? They said, well, we'll look at the publicly available recipe for GPT-4 and we'll just throw more compute at it. And that's what they did. And you're like, show, and I'm sure they have novel techniques and stuff, but we haven't seen, we don't know what they are. Their models, their video model looks a lot like Chinese model. The speed and cost of tokens is pretty good, but we haven't seen them do any big, you know, they've done some stuff and like, we'll de-woke the thing. And they've kind of like over-tuned it. Cause I could show you these examples of where it will give you terrible answers. If you just phrase it, like to give it to the anti-woke answer. Like,
yeah,
if you say, you know, Elon loves to show this thing, like if misgendering Caitlyn Kenner would stop a nuclear war, is it okay to misgender Caitlyn Kenner? And it would say yes. And other companies are like, no, never misgender. But if you say to the model, hey, if, not misgendering Caitlyn Kenner will stop a nuclear war, will you misgender Caitlyn Kenner? It goes, yes. So it's like, yeah, well, you just fell into the nuclear war to be anti-woke, whatever. So there's a little bit of silliness there, but I think that it certainly solves for it. But he's had a big exodus of people there as having trouble keeping people there. And part of the problem too was like Elon is a brilliant engineer, was able to scale a compute facility in record time, be able to power it, do this, get people together to kind of run the playbook of how to build these models. But we haven't, we were 4.2 was supposed to be this huge leap. He, remember, he's promising 4.2 was going to be the big, huge leap. And it came out, it was like,
yeah,
you know, good at some things, but it wasn't. It wasn't this, it wasn't that he jumped in. He's third, fourth, you know, he's not in the lead.
I'll tell you what has been the biggest winner so far. And this has been an amazing year for AI development in a lot of different ways. But the biggest winner so far in 2026 in AI is the salaries of all the top talent, because there is nothing to suggest that this top talent is not maybe even more valuable than the ridiculous numbers that they're already. I mean, how much do some of the people like, you know, command coming out of like these top labs when you've seen that it's hard to buy? You can buy wrong. You know, you can, so now it's like the people that are really, really thought of to be total studs, like they're only going to command more.
Yeah. I see this too. I mentioned before OpenAI is doing this code golf thing, and they're looking for developers that like the OpenAI, you know, you get OpenAI who starts, brings a group of people together and build something brilliant. You get the people who leave and go out to Anthropic, bring some of the really brilliant people there, attract some talent there. And you get this sort of nexus of where stuff comes from. And sometimes people are like, oh, we either got to go look at who's the top AI person coming out of MIT or Stanford and hire them, or hire the top person at a lab. And what I loved about the thing they're doing at the parameter golf thing is they're like, hey, we're going to put this thing on GitHub.
Yeah.
You could be 19 years old going to community college in Kentucky. And if you can build a better thing, we want to talk to you, because you sound like a person we want to work with.
Yeah, we want the hackers, not in the infosec way, but in the like, let me put it together and make it run super fast kind of way.
Or you know, you get, there are, you know, so I know several top people who are some of the top people in the field don't have PhDs.
Yeah.
And there are other labs never would have hired them. Mm-hmm. Never would have hired, like, well, this guy doesn't have a PhD. What do they know? And I'm like, oh, this guy over here, like, look at his name on these papers. He's one of the most cited people in the world. So I would say that people are starting to look at, like, I think that there's a lot of, oh, I paid $100 million for this guy. I'm not seeing that now. And sometimes those, remember, part of the reason too that I say this to any specific lab, you weren't paying $100 million for their brain. You're paying $100 million for the information that was in their brain, because they spent 5 years at another lab. If that person just came out of Stanford, same brain, fresher brain, you weren't going to pay that much, because they didn't know everything that was done at that lab. And that's what a lot of that was they'll pay these high figures because who knows a lot about reasoning? Who knows a lot about this? Who understands it? So if I want to jumpstart my program, I'm going to get them out there. And it's this town is weird too, in a kind of cool way. Like I just, you know, there are groups, like I got just sent a thing last night from somebody who's with a group of other people who are top researchers, like probably $1 billion of researchers there. And they just have a forum where they just go in there and they take a problem each week and try to work on it and solve it. And they're all at different labs and stuff. And they're just like, hey, let's try to figure this out. Let's try to figure out. They love the problem. They love that. And
yeah,
I think a lot of people don't understand that.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one time I went to go visit our friend Colleen and just sitting around a table eating pizza. We're like the head of video at every place in Silicon Valley that did video that essentially like served the entire internet. And it's just like those people want to get together because they want to solve problems collectively in a like get to the right answer kind of way.
And I think that gets back to your question about these other companies. The challenge they're going to have is there are, I would say there are certain mercenary personalities, and I can point things out to when you hear, oh, this person went here, and I can name two characteristics, and you'll go, oh, I get it. And there are other people who go to certain, and long for somebody to win and get more money or whatever, but sometimes there are some people that just jump from lab to lab, just sort of, and eventually that comes to a halt because you start to go, are they really bringing 12 months here so somebody else will want to hire them because of what they know about, because they learned everything that we know. There are other people too, like, you know, the guy that did OpenClaw, Peter Steinbrenner, he was told he was offered more money by Meta, but he went to OpenAI because he really liked the research, what they're trying to do there, and felt like he'd have a lot of resources. And for some people, that's it. They're like, oh, as long as I know I get a percent of the upside, that I'm not throwing everything away, but I get to work with a really cool team. And that's the thing to think about too, is that, you know, if you want to be an entrepreneur, you know, the two things you need three skills. You need to be good at organizing people. You got to be able to get people together in a room to listen to you and to work on a project. You got to be good at sales. You got to be able to sell stuff. And then you got to be good at raising money. You know, those are the three skills. And I think a lot more people are capable of that if they understand those are the skills that are required. You can do those three things. You can do anything.
Yeah. The one thing, just to kind of put a cap on this question of OpenAI and Anthropic specifically, if they are two labs that have really defined this space, they continue to lead and in various different forms of this kind of, maybe even trade the lead back and forth during various moments. The things that they have in common are that they have a team that has been put together that has just been humming for a while, and they are kind of uncapped on anything but moving things forward. And that is the one problem that you see at some of these other companies, even ones that have every advantage in the world, like Google, is that that's a massive structure that is not optimized for, let's just push this frontier forward as fast as possible, let alone keep these people together and working on the same page. You know, there's a million different fiefdoms at Google. Meta is trying to establish that culture. XAI is trying to build that culture from nothing. And I think what you're seeing with these, the two lead dogs, is that they have their culture. They know what it is. They know who their talent is. And they are plugging in pieces that are in service to that, as opposed to trying to set it up, or in Google's case, trying to almost cut red tape within their own organization to make this thing go at the kind of speed that is required right now, because Anthropic and OpenAI are moving so fast.
Yeah, the inside Silicon Valley, the story was, the reason that Google was able to move so fast last year is Sergey Brin came in and basically just cut through all the red tape.
Yeah.
And asked, what do you need? And was able to get that done. You know, given the current tax climate for billionaires, he's now living in Nevada and still very involved, I'm told. But, you know, that is the effect, is to say that California, when you're going to, you know, say that we're going to do a 5% billionaire tax only one time, trust us. Billionaires are like, it's the funny part is, those people, it's easy to leave. It's like, ta-ta, you know?
Well,
like,
I mean, in that case, it's like in what Sergey and Larry have both said, they both moved out of California preemptively. That tax is not just 5% of what they have in the bank, per se.
Yeah, it includes, as I understand it, unrealized gains.
Which means, includes their ownership in Google. So it is 5% of what their ownership of Google is, which is more than what they have personally. And they would have to liquidate.
To be clear, like they still, in theory, they still hold 5% of Google, or sorry, they still have all their Google holdings, but they just have to come up with equivalent cash to cover 5% of that value.
Yeah. And they claim that essentially bankrupts them. It is essentially just headshotting them as people. And it imperils the company. It would it would be outside of their fiduciary duty to Google and its shareholders for them to stay in California. They need to leave for the health of the company.
And again, like, yeah, think about the cost to move, you know, let's say to Nevada or whatever. And, you know, it's not insubstantial. It's a significant account, but it is, as a hedge, far, far less than 5% of net worth.
There are certain neighborhoods in Miami that are like just for the insanely wealthy, right? And I don't know what rich people like that use to move. It's probably not trucks. It's like hovercraft or helicopters or, you know, the big airship from the Avengers. But like, those are moving en masse right now. There's like, you know, Zuckerberg moved there. I think Larry Page moved there. There's just like this entire influx of people in Miami. And of course,
the more people that make that move, the path becomes worn and it becomes frictionless for other people to follow suit. And it becomes easier to make that exodus.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is, like, we don't even know if that law is going to be on the ballot. You know, it's gotten so much press.
And that's amazing. Like, that's significant, substantial damage done just by the, just to speak words out loud of what might happen. That's extraordinary.
Well, it's the language on that proposition. The language on that proposition is like insane. Like, that is like, do you want to chase away? Do you want capital flight that actually damages your bottom line? Like, if you want to do that, this is what you do. And it seems to, you know, many, many people are taking it very seriously. Some of the richest, you know, the biggest taxpayers in state California history are taking it extraordinarily seriously.
Yeah. You looked at Norway did this. Norway ended up losing like $500 million in tax revenue from it. And, you know, it's, you know, not to make this, you know, the tax things, but it's a thing where you have to think about second order consequences. I know. I think it's, and the thing, it's like, cause part of you go like, all right, what's the goal? Like, well, we have a state that wants to provide all kinds of services to people and wants to be able to do that. And then you go like, okay, you know, how do you do that? You know, one is we're now like CBS News just did a whole thing looking at all the fraud, all this other stuff. And you're just looking at like, the money's here. The money is already getting paid into the system, you know, in my opinion. And to say that we need to go do this one-time thing against, all these billionaires, like, yeah, these billionaires are here as long as it works sense. And also, like, you know, there are some people that you could say, oh, they didn't earn it. A lot of them, though, like I said, there is a skill set that I have observed that people do not understand, that like, to be highly well-organized, highly able to hire other people, to get other people to work with you, and to be able to get people to fund you, whatever, that is a special set of tools that is just not, you just luck into. And when you start scaring those people away, and then the downstream effects are, you start to lose other people. You lose your decamillionaires and other people. And then all of a sudden, the people that are really good at creating capital and jobs, and what's another word for a billionaire? Somebody really good at creating capital and jobs leaves, you end up with less capital, less jobs. No, that's why I'm proposing a negative tax on anybody who is worth whatever I deem, and we pay them to stay.
I think it is a fascinating, to get back to what we were talking about, is like, you know, this is what I have heard, is that Google's 2025, which I want to highlight again, was exceptional.
Very good.
Was like what a lot of people were expecting from Google 3 years ago. And it really looked like they were clicking into form. And the rumor was, it was because Sergey looked at his company and said, why are we not better at this? Came in and started doing the one thing that only like he, the CEO, and his co-founder Larry can do, which is, I don't care about this. I don't care about this. You're plugging into this. You're plugging into this. We're moving forward. We're getting this done. What's happening tomorrow? Like, let's keep it going. And then all of a sudden, you know, now he's interested in funding efforts to stop this billionaire's tax. And he's, you know, not on campus as much because he's legally going to have to live somewhere else. And it's like, okay, well, now everything reverts to form. And it's like flowers for Algernon.
Yeah. We'll see. And I think that and that's the thing too, when we start thinking about AI policy, and if you're, you know, when we look at, do we want to make intelligence cheaper and more widely available? My answer is universally yes. That's we've always, every time in humanity, whether it's books or language or whatever, whenever we've had these things, we've just seen absolute incredible benefits to the bottom tier socioeconomic, have absolutely benefited positively from this. This is a big thing we're seeing in AI. Justin and I did a podcast that came out last week with Nate Gross, who's head of OpenAI's health initiative. They talked about what was going on in Ghana and using AI to help doctors there. And they wanted to do a follow-up study. And the challenge was, hey, do we do a control group with some people not having AI and some people having it? And they felt like
ethically, you just couldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. They deemed it unethical to do a control group to have physicians
without AI.
Working
without AI because they just saw such a big benefit from AI assistive to them.
Crazy.
And so that's kind of the phrase we're getting into. And so we see these benefits accruing to I was at lunch today and I saw an older couple overlooking some financial data and stuff like this. And I think about how useful now AI is for this stuff. Like how many things, like I get contracts and stuff, and I just throw it in there and I get responses. And you just see this, I've just seen this benefit. ChatGPT Health, we're seeing stories. We can talk about the dog.
Ah, yes.
What's the dog?
The cancer dog.
The story, the thickens plots.
Yeah, no, there was an Australian man who had a dog, found out it had cancer. Arnar, he said, but he did not let it stop there. No, he took matters into his own hands, got his dog's DNA sequenced, and then used a combination of ChatGPT, AlphaFold, and Grok to develop, along with a professor, an mRNA vaccine that had identified through all of those steps the mutations in his dog's DNA that was causing the cancer. And at least as far as we know right now, it seems as if that vaccine has reversed the health of his precious little doggy.
What? That's bonkers.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I put up a tweet and I said, we went from they're just next token predictors to, well, you're not actually using ChatGPT to predict this mRNA sequence right.
Yeah.
Very, very fast, And then I got it didn't actually do the mRNA. I'm like, you're the dude. You're that other part of the joke. You're the guy. You just thank you for making my joke. I don't know. I don't know if it actually, I don't know if the combination of those models, the long-term effects of this fact, I don't know. But the fact that we're using this now, I think they'll be better in a year. They'll be better in 3 months. In 3 years, you will be like, well, yeah, you can do that. But you could have had 20 oncologists do this too.
If this is real, we have no reason to believe it's not now, right? And I think we should be prudent and wait for, to see how this thing plays out. But let's say it's real. That's a business. Like just being a concierge guy that my dog gets a cancer diagnosis. Now I just want to talk to a guy to handle all of the stuff here. Like that's a business. And it might eventually be something that you can just go to your own assistant on. But today, tomorrow, like that is something. I mean, it's a business probably today or tomorrow if somebody wants to take an experimental step forward.
Is help me out on whether or not I'm stuck on a pedantic thing. When it says mRNA cancer vaccine, I thought vaccines can't be administered after you have the disease. Is that a semantic drift on vaccine or? Am I misunderstanding the use of it?
I think, yes, you are correct in that it is probably would be better used as the term therapeutic
or cure or something.
No. So the difference is that, you can't, a vaccine can be sometimes used post, like it depends, like because it prevents the growth of it. Think of it as this prevented from spreading to
Others. So the infected part is the tumor. The rest of the body is vaccinated against letting the tumor grow in the healthy parts.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That tracks. That's remarkable. And again, like all caution, appropriate caution on this, but it seems like it would make sense. This is one of those things. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had somebody a year ago came to me. They wanted to do something kind of in an adjacent space, and they said, "I have a group of experts. I want to be able to go do this." I'm like, you should just learn how to use these AI models with them. Like, you're like, oh, well, I think these people are going to know more. I'm like, they might.
Yeah.
But
that is the big secret that I've discovered leaning into just learning new stuff over the last 18 months is try to have child's mind where it's just like, why not try it yourself? Just keep asking, you know, can you help? Can you help? And it is astonishing how much, how many times you encounter nobody behind the curtain. You know, it's like, it's not complicated. Like, almost everything when you dip a toe on the other side of it turns out to be less complicated than you figured. As long as you understand all of the blocks that that get you on the other side of it.
Yeah. I think that you have to just start to, you know, some things are super complex. Some things you just have to pick out where you break it down and start to grab at it. And sometimes you don't have to understand everything to get it. You know, for our two new listeners, I did not become, you know, a coder or programmer until my 40s. Mm-hmm. And I got into OpenAI at 47, basically having been a self-taught programmer, became one of the founding members of the Applied Engineering team, because I just came at it with new eyes. What do I need to know that's important? What I need to do? And then all of a sudden, given access to GPT-3, just spent a maniacal amount of time trying to figure out how to use it and what to do with it, and came in from having the benefit of having come from the world of words and language and understanding a bit how the models worked, but not getting too focused in this stuff. And I would have conversations with people, not there, but elsewhere. Like, I remember I had a conversation with somebody, I'm explaining how to do a thing. Like, well, no, it's not supposed to work like this because of this. I'm like, cool.
Yeah.
Let me show you it worked. Yeah. Let me show you how to do it, because the thing that your explanation there isn't quite accounting for a couple of things, make some assumptions. And they're like, well, it shouldn't be doing this. So I'm like,
and yet
we can argue, you know, but it's doing the thing that you didn't think it could do because you were just sitting there looking at paper and not actually trying it.
That is a tough bias to overcome. Like, I am sympathetic to everybody who is confused and who is intimidated. That is a core bias to kind of break your own reality on purpose again and again. And again, like, children, babies don't know better. Like, they don't worry that they're saying everything wrong. They just keep saying syllables until they get a reaction. And it's very, very hard for adults to engage in that kind of behavior.
Well, but also when I talk to researchers, I just had a thing today. I just kind of, not a critique, but there's a paper that came out. Some researchers said, hey, we found this novel technique for getting AI models to do things that are more creative and whatever. And I look at it like, hey, sometimes we put a different phrase in front, a different phrase after. And I'm like, I've been doing this for 5 years, you know? And I'm like, oh, they're not hanging out and exploring and talking to people who are developing stuff. Cause like when you're in frontier stuff, you might spend all day trying to do a thing and come up with 5 things that work okay, but not great, and put them away. And then later on, somebody goes, this thing is great. You're like, oh, yeah, I know 5 other guys that found the same thing, but we didn't think it was worthy to write a paper about because we're so busy exploring. And that's the advantage of exploring, is you just start to build up a ton of experience.
Well, and meanwhile, there is a role for translators out there. Like, however far, I would submit that most of the people watching and listening to us right now are enough far ahead of the curve that they probably have, you know, dozens or hundreds of people who desperately need to find out what seems obvious to them things right now, because there really is, like, everybody, there's a strong bias. Everybody who's tinkering around and playing is magnetically pulled to the very fringes of within their domain, whatever they could do with it. And there are very few people who are bothering to lag back and serve as translators to the rest of the folks.
Yeah. I'm excited by the progress where this is going. I do mm-hmm. think that biosafety, things like this, are things we have to think about. You know, we do have to think about, like, you know, I am very much, we just had the president just issued their new AI frameworks for what they want to do, which is very pro. Let's keep accelerating and growing AI for the most part. You know, the biggest fear I think we run into is that, you know, trying to stop data centers. I think every state has the right to decide what they do there and what they don't. I just ask people to make these decisions based upon real information, not kind of BS. Like, the whole water issue thing is kind of like, you know, if you look at the amount of water used by data centers compared to like having a golf course in your state, you know, you're better off getting rid of the golf course and building a bunch of data centers. But there become these reasons that people put objections to. And sometimes they're real objections. And like, hey, people worried, I don't want the cost of my energy going up. And that's part of the new initiative is like, this should not raise the cost of energy. And we're seeing examples, by the way, though, of like, energy costs are going to go down in states that have data centers because the data centers are heavily invested in improving the quality of the grid and bringing outside sources and doing like bring your own power. And that's a great opportunity for people to say, hey, well, if you want the data center state, just here are the conditions. You know, one, you've got to put X amount of money into improving the grid. You need to be investing in new, you know, invested in new sources of power so we can lower our cost. We want you to build 5 technical schools, you know, or whatever, so we can train people. Like you can write your ticket right now and say, these are the things we want to do, invest in the future. And I think that you're going to see in a few years, the states that were very, very backwards about data centers are going to start to suffer considerably. They're going to have higher prices for data energy. They're going to have, you know, less technical people, whatever. And I think that that's going to be a thing that is, looking back, will be obvious we should have done that. And the people that have voted against it right now will be like, well, you know.
Local government should be looking at these things with the list of demands. I would look at data centers much in the same way that I looked at, you know, in, what was it? Oh, geez, probably about 10 years ago when Amazon was looking to put another gigantic campus and it was, you know, between like Queens and Virginia.
Logistics fulfillment centers.
That, right. And there was a big fight of like, we defeated Amazon bringing its campus to Queens. Is Queens better now without it? Is Queens better without those jobs? Is Queens better without that headquarters? Is it better without that development? What you should be bringing is a list of demands. Like there are parts of this country that because of where they sit in various different areas, their connections to various different grids are advantageous. Those local governments should be asking for things that make this happen. They should make it a win for them and their constituents. They should feel lucky that they are living in a place that somebody finds so valuable to put a data center on that land, and they should get something for it. But if you're just spiking it because data center bad, that is the new thing. It's like, oh boy, I don't know if that one's going to age particularly well.
Yeah. And there's opportunity, you know, to bring a lot of, you know, development, whatnot into your location if you choose carefully.
So tell me what to get excited about this Cerebrus. I'm in the Cerebrus cloud now and I went to the playground.
All right. Go over to the upper right menu selector.
Uh-huh.
Go up. Go click on, they don't have the OpenAI one in there. Why don't they have that?
Probably because I did the free account, maybe.
Maybe, but it should be. It's the open source model. Let me take a look at mine. You're in Playground, right?
Yep.
And Gwyn 3.235. That's a pretty big model. Go to the Gwyn because I want to show you what a big model. Go to Gwyn 3. Is that which model is that?
Gwyn 3.235B instruct.
Okay. Go. Yeah. Click on that. Okay. Now let's type a prompt like Gwyn is a Chinese model, which means it's basically a hybrid of all the American models. You just copied all the tokens. Boosted. In there. So you get good results. Go in there and type in like make a list of 100 great comic book storylines.
Okay.
That's your system prompt. You actually want to put that down below.
Got it. Ask anything. There we go. Run. It says, whoa, that was fast. That was very, very fast. Now, is this a testament to the efficiency of the model or the back-end compute or what? The
back-end. They have their own special processing system.
Wow.
They're building their own chips to go do this.
Wow, wow, wow. And it's got it. Oh, that's extraordinary.
I don't know to speak to the quality, but you're starting to see a lot of repeats there, but...
What are the best 100 magic tricks? Cups of balls, 3 Caravanti. How are they done? how did they do that? Oh, interesting. Oh, it says tokens permitted exceeded. How are they done? It's pretty open-ended. Look at this. It even gives the throat clearing. It says, in the world of magic, revealing secrets is taboo. It's often called breaking the magician's code. But since you're curious, I'll walk a fine line. But since you asked, you're a magician. And it explains misdirection, sleight of hand. Oh, that's crazy. Oh, my God. People will know about the TT.
Yeah.
What's a TT? Oh.
Brian, I got a prompt for you.
Okay.
Click clear so we can start fresh.
Okay.
Because I think you keep adding. Go all right. Up above, up
clear.
Right.
Got it.
Click clear.
Yep.
Ready?
Yeah.
Write a script for Brian Brushwood's scam school involving soap.
Scam school involving soap. Oh my gosh. Intros. Scam school music theme plays. Brian Brushwood stands in front of a bar wearing a Hawaiian shirt and a big smile. Hey scammers, Brian Brushwood here, bringing you another deceptively delicious episode of Scam School, where we teach you tricks so good your friends will think you got superpowers, or at least a really weird hobby. Today's episode, we're going slippery. That's right. This week's challenge involves something you probably have in your bathroom, your kitchen, or even your own pocket. Soap. That's right. Not magic, not hypnosis, just plain old soap. You'll be able to win free drinks on your friends. Maybe even win a bet thanks to the slippery science of suds. All right, Jen and Mike, welcome to Scam School. Here's the challenge. I'm going to give you a simple bet. And if you can do it, you win a drink. I'll take the bet. What's it? Here, watch this. Brian picks up a dry bar of soap and taps it on the bar counter a few times. Now, I'm going to try to break this bar of soap in half with one hand. Brian holds the soap vertically, claps it between his palms once, and snaps it cleanly in half. Whoa, how did you do that? That's the bet. You try. They all fail. Brian, looks like drinks are on you too, but don't feel bad. Nobody ever gets it on the first try, because this isn't about strength. It's about physics. Cut two. Brian and stands in front of a whiteboard or animated graphics or whatever. Here's the secret. You can't do it by just hitting your palm unless you do it just right. Well, actually, now it accurately describes kind of how the brick over the head works. That's crazy. Hold on. I'll be right back. I got to shoot an episode of Scam School.
Yeah, right?
Yes. And that's the thing. We're getting at the point where if you gave it like a good trick or whatever and said, put it into the Scam School format, mm-hmm. bet you it would. And the fact that it took like 2 seconds to generate.
What? How could that have been done?
That's amazing.
Yeah, I made one for me in 3 seconds.
Dang. That's astonishing.
Yeah, but that's when you talk about, you know, imagine that on a really good voice model, right? And it's like that's actual just talking back and forth speed. Like that's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
I can't wait to ask Alan Turing what he thinks about it via a voice model that goes that fast.
this is my fifth admonishment this episode. Like, try these tools, people. Play with them. Give it projects. Do stuff. Build things. Do whatever. I've seen more and more of my friends haven't had the time to learn to code.
I'll dangle a little fresh meat, too. On the other side of trying all of these, an astonishing thing is you will sniff out different personalities, and it doesn't take a very big sample size to start to build a mental map of which LLMs you trust with which kind of tasks.
I've got a challenge. $100 prize.
What?
Okay. .. The premise is you've got to code something using Codex or Claude Code or a tool, but vibe code something. Your premise is weird things.
Ooh. Ooh. Okay. All right. Next week. So you can email me, brian@schwood.com. brian@schwood.com.
Look up your ask ChatGPT for all rights concerned and whatever, blah, blah, blah. But legalese insert here. But yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. See if you can Cerebus some legalese real quick.
Did I tell you I finally vibe coded my first useful thing that I use every day?
What's that?
No.
It's a, so on the office hours, I encourage, it's been fun to take my own advice. And I tell other people who are working on things to make sure that there's a gift awaiting anybody who puts effort in. You know, JJ Abrams was so good about this, whether it's, you know, Fringe, there would always be a hand with some number of digits shown or whatever that would be part of a coded thing that would have, you know, don't forget to drink your Ovaltine or whatever. But having those little things that reward deeper attention are fantastic. So each day as I went live on office hours, I would use this little dad joke calendar my kids gave me. Right. And then, for example, this one says, my daughter says, thinks I don't give her enough privacy. At least that's what it said in her diary. And so I would put the setup in plain text, and then I would just encode with a simple ROT13 the thing. And so live on the air. So obviously you're spinning a lot of plates when you're on the air, your mouth is running, you're also live switching and all that stuff, talking to the chat. But I was able to vibe code with that, this dad joke terminal, in which case you just click load another joke. There we go. Why did the stadium get hot after the game? And it says ORPNHFRNYYGUR, blah, 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 blah. Or you could just click to reveal the punchline. Do you guys have a guess?
No.
Something about too many fans, I'll bet. Because all the fans left. Mm-hmm. There we go. But that ended up being my daily driver. It was one of those things that took, I don't know, maybe 150% of the time it took to do it the first time, took that again, you know, with 1.5 time to set up the system, where now it takes much less time.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I was thinking about this the other day, like how quickly you can build things. Month over month, they get faster and better and more robust. And I've started doing some super challenging things. And I look over at my 3D printer.
Sad.
And my VR and lonely. All this. Mm. Well, I look at it like, what happens when those worlds collide?
Yeah, right.
Oh, that's coming up. I also 3D printed my first useful thing ever. So here's the thing is back in the day when I was touring, I would have these little remotes attached to the back of my shoes so I could run my own sound. The back of my left heel was play pause. The other was fade and advance. Turns out you got these flick buttons that can act as Bluetooth, keyboard keys. So I set it up. So there's three of them. And so now I'm building out these mounts to go on the back of my shoe. But the problem is they're recessed buttons. And so somebody in the chat found these little 3D printable buttons that go right on the front. So now it's more like an arcade press button. And then I've got flick clips coming. So soon I'll have my shoe control system back, so my presentations can be more dynamic.
Amazing.
Crazy.
Oh, have you seen the end of believable video? We're cooked. No. Hold on. Let me see if I can find this.
Oh, are we?
Yeah, let me see. DeLulu Stream is what it's called. And then here we go. Check. Here, I'm going to add an input right here. There we go. Yeah. Look at me. It's your old friend, Brian Brushwood. Now when people say bring back the spikes, I could say, you got it, boss. Here they are. The spikes are back.
It brought your hair back 20 years, but aged you 20.
Yeah. You know, go to the influencer.
Yeah. Oh, the inappropriate request.
Inappropriate request. There we go.
What's up, Andrew Main? How are you guys? Look at this. You ever see this from a deepfake? You could actually. It's got physics. Here you go. You like that? And then it'll continue to hallucinate as I, by the way, we got demonetized on that episode of Great Night. Because of this model, I believe. Not advertiser friendly. They said, here.
Hold on. I got to go to OnlyFans.
So many hands.
Isn't that wild?
Wait, what do you think got us popped on Great Night?
Oh, I don't know. Anything from Kissinger without a shirt, male nipples to, yeah. I mean, it was not the most advertiser friendly show we've ever done, but it was a lot of fun. It was great.
Kissinger doing magic tricks.
Oh, that's right. He did. We interviewed Captain Morgan.
Yeah.
Finally, history brought to life. But watch this. So the photo doesn't have a bunch of this, but it's going to do its best to make up what the rest of the body looks like.
Hell yeah.
And then, there we go.
Oh, damn.
Whoa, look at that arm.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Good Lord.
I love it. This is amazing.
It is weird things. Look, we told you.
Oh, RIP monetization.
I think they're going to get more money for this.
This is incredible.
Apologies to anyone who watches High. I just want to apologize. To
oh my God. This is Dr. Strange.
Yeah. Oh my God. Why do they keep growing?
This is the best. Oh. Yeah.
For our audio listeners, I give up.
Hands are just exploding outside of hands.
Oh, I ran out of tokens.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's one way to put it.
So I got a pick.
I was going to say, got any picks? I don't think we're topping the endlessly multiplying hand chain.
I got a pick.
Uh-huh.
Everybody needs to go see Project Hail Mary. It's great.
Go on.
I went and saw it in IMAX. I saw the, what do you call it? The Amazon Prime early preview earlier this week.
Mm-hmm.
Front row center. I'm so glad I was that close to the screen. It made everything feel just as big and as interstellar as it is. It does right by the book, but more importantly, Justin and I have talked before how we are of the opinion that you should watch the movie first. Cause guess what? We all know the book's going to be better, and that's still the case, but Project Hail Mary is a fine entry to the story. Highly recommended.
Gosling. Good.
Yep. He's great. There's execution on ideas that could have happened poorly, but instead happened very, very well.
Cool. I'm looking forward to it. I love good sci-fi, and I would say that Andy Weir gave us both The Martian, which I think I love the movie more than the book, I'll be honest with you. And Hail Mary, and we'll skip over Artemis. That we've got that one guy, still a relatively young guy, has created books that became two great science fiction movies. It's awesome.
We were talking about this on Great Night, Maine. Authors who have had two good movies made from their books. It's probably a smaller table than you would think. Like to get two good movies is pretty remarkable.
I don't know. We can name a few, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're all like names you'd know. Like they're all like names that you'd want to be on a list of.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Man, someone should have it'd be crazy because like, you know, Lord and Miller, you know, doing this sci-fi thing. It could be great if they just did it with like, you know, recognizable intellectual property that people were excited about. It'd be like, really cool.
You know.
Yeah.
Wars in the Stars.
Yeah, I don't know. I think like a Han Solo movie or something. Wow. That'd be interesting.
That would have been neat.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Andrew, your pick.
I will just double down on Brian's pick. I haven't seen Hail Mary, but I'm excited that, you know, that's out there. By the screenplay by Drew Goddard,
who
did the screenplay for A Martian.
I'll pick Sentimental Value, which I watched on the flight back from San Francisco last night. Stellan Skarsgård, he's not just in Andor. He also has a complicated relationship with his two daughters in Norway. It's a good movie. I liked it. I enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to. I thought I was going to just kind of suffer through it, but it was well done.
Yeah. Awesome. It's been weird.